Hello everyone, and this is New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. And today's episode is in conversation with Laura Olson, who co-authored with Svetlana Adonyeva a fascinating book called The Worlds of Russian Village Women: Tradition, Transgression, Compromise. This is a study of three generations of Russian village women, and it makes one reconsider our understanding of gender and the role of women in Russian culture. So, I'm really looking forward to what Laura has to say about her and Svetlana's book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. And I'm thrilled to have a chance today to be talking to Laura Olson-Osterman. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
Pretty good, thanks.
So, today we are going to be talking about the book called The Worlds of Russian Village Women: Tradition, Transgression, Compromise, by Laura Olson-Osterman and Svetlana Adonyeva. So Laura, it's usually very interesting to find out how people got to be doing what they are doing now. So perhaps you could tell us about your story in Russian studies.
Sure. As a young child, I loved foreign languages. And I grew up in a suburb of New York City, and we had a neighbor. Actually, when we were on vacation in Vermont, there was a neighbor who was a Russian man, and he had a husky dog, and he spoke to the dog in Russian. And that was the first Russian that I met, and I didn't really meet him. I just observed him like a child does, you know, and that made an impression on me. And then later on in high school, I had a chance to study Russian. My French teacher was a Russian immigrant from somewhere in probably what's now Poland. And she taught French and she also taught Russian. And so I signed up with her for Russian. And she taught me to speak for some reason with a very different accent than is usually taught in English schools or American schools. And so I had to relearn Russian when I attended college, but I think I caught the bug, you know, pretty early. And, you know, as many times in my life as I've said to myself, why am I studying this? Why didn't I choose French cheese making or something? It just has really stuck with me.
So cheese making, would you like to talk a little bit more about this? Is this a hobby of yours?
Yeah, no, it isn't. But all I meant by that was sometimes when you're doing field work in Russia, especially if you're there in the winter, especially in times when there was more difficulty to obtain good food and that kind of thing, I would fantasize about why I chose this particular place in the world to focus my energies.
Yeah, I guess this is not uncommon for Slavic scholars, especially during winters.
I think so. Yeah, and sometimes village life is like that too. But, you know, village life really draws you in with all the social interaction. And that's probably what drew me to studying Russian village culture, was that when I first started going to Russian villages, the people were so open and so willing to share their lives, share the time that it takes to tell stories. And this made a huge impression on me. And so I think that really influenced my future study of Russian culture.
So I think you mentioned somewhere in your book that there is a 10-year-long story of fieldwork behind it.
Yes, and how that started, I have a strong interest in folk singing. And I got this from my mother, who was in a folk singing group in Larchmont, New York, that would sing like for old people's homes and, you know, with guitars and tambourines and that kind of thing. 1960s kind of Pete Seeger folk revival. And I would go along sometimes and, you know, I learned all their songs, and I was a good singer. I loved singing. And, you know, I always sang in classical choirs, but when I found Russian folk music, I felt like I had really found what I wanted to do musically. And so part of what I did, what drew me into studying Russian village culture was the music. And that's where the field work started. When I first started researching Russian folk music, it was not possible to go to a village. In 1989, when I first went to Eastern Europe to study folk music, I studied through the auspices of the Dmitry Pokrovsky Ensemble. And we had met Dmitry Pokrovsky when they were on tour in the United States. And I just loved their music and their sound and wanted to, you know, sort of apprentice myself to them and become, you know, familiar with really what they did and their practice and their field work as well, because they were a folk ensemble that did their own field work in Russian villages to get their own repertoire. It's repertoire, but to kind of get the sound, to get the physical aspect of Russian folk singing. And I wrote my book about the whole phenomenon around the Pokrovsky Ensemble. That book is called Performing Russia. And at the time that I did that research, which was in 1989-90, it was really hard to go out to a Russian village. Like, I had one ethnomusicologist say she could take me, like, if we were willing to just kind of get on a train and go. And I was with two other women from the Yale Slavic Chorus. We didn't want to do it in those conditions. We wanted to have, you know, full permission to go and all of that. So it wasn't until 95 that I made my first trip to a Russian village. And that was again through an ethnomusicologist. Her name is Natalia Gilyarova. And I wrote about her in my first book. And so I observed her method of working with informants in the village. And I met some of my very first informants and some of the main informants of my second book, The World's Russian Village Women, through Natalia Gilyarova. That was the start of the folk, of the field research.
That's a very interesting segue into Russian culture.
It is, yeah. And I remember at the time I was on an ACTR, an American Council of Teachers of Russian language program. And it was when Gilyarova said to me, I can take you out to a village. I told my Russian teacher, you know, I'd have to miss a few days of class. Would it be okay? And she was like, oh my God, yes, you're going to learn so much more there than you could in a classroom. And she was so right. I mean, I was like, you know, it just sort of changed my life. And it was there that I first heard the stories of Valentina Sergeyevna, who is one of the informants that is featured throughout the book, but especially in the witchcraft chapter 7. And she told there one of the main stories, which I didn't understand when she told it, but later on the other people that I was with on this little fieldwork expedition told me what she had been saying, because people tell stories in a way that even if you understand the words they're saying, you don't understand what's going on. So it was a whole language that I had to learn. And basically, what the story that she told there was that another woman in the ensemble, in her little folk ensemble inside this village, the ensemble that Gilyarova, the ethnomusicologist, studies, had put a spell on her, Valentina, so that Valentina would get hoarse, and so she wouldn't be able to sing when Gilyarova was there to make a recording of their singing group. So this was, and I thought, how interesting, because Valentina is a nurse and she yet believes that a cold can be given to someone through witchcraft, like not through, you know, germs, but through witchcraft. So that just started the beginning of my interest in this and my knowledge even. I didn't know that such stories were told in villages, and I didn't know what they were called. And so that really started me to learn what they're called and to pay attention to these stories and see how I could elicit more stories like that. And it turns out you don't really need to elicit them. You just need to kind of be there and listen to elder women talk. And eventually these stories float up all by themselves.
That's incredibly interesting. And while we are on this, I had another question I wanted to ask you. So you mentioned in the introduction that one of the difficulties of doing research in a village is that you have to overcome various misunderstandings between the researcher and the village woman. So what other kind of misunderstandings do you mean?
Oh my gosh, just so many. I mean, when I went to, so this was the idea of Svetlana Adonieva, my co-author. And, you know, she kind of, you know, just mentioned this to me. And when she mentioned it to me, and then we wrote about it, I started going back through literally my tapes and listening to see if there really were misunderstandings. And I found them everywhere. For example, just like laughing at the wrong place in the story of someone's telling a story and I'm laughing and it's not funny, or, you know, I'm expecting one outcome and, the person is saying a different outcome. And so my questions are going in a different direction. I wrote about it in a different article in a collection on, oral history. I did like a close reading of one of my interviews with another of my favorite women that I met in the village. And I pulled out all of the misunderstandings, and it wasn't, and I was surprised, or maybe not surprised, I was maybe glad to see it wasn't just my misunderstandings, but also I had a student with me, a Russian student, who Svetlana arranged for me to do field work with. And she was having as many misunderstandings as I did. So I knew it wasn't that I didn't understand, you know, the culture or the language. I mean, it is because I don't understand the culture. But it's more like there's a special type of misunderstanding that happens when city people go to the village. And it doesn't matter if you're American or Russian, you're still going to have that kind of cognitive dissonance when you encounter the culture of the villagers.
I see. Well, as we are getting into more details, perhaps you could talk a little bit about the structure of your book and the main themes you've raised in this book.
Yeah. So I have to say the book, it started as my project, and then Svetlana's contribution came. My idea was to investigate the story of how the intellectuals of Russia had really inscribed Russian women into a particular story about Russian folklore and Russia's greatness, as Russia's culture draws on its folklore, and the Russian women are the, you know, keepers of this great, rich, you know, kind of richness, but they are also kind of not perfect, not good keepers, because the way that they keep folklore is by just like transmitting it kind of in a rote way, not by, you know, really preserving the important aspects of the folklore, or by taking it to its great heights of mastery. So, and I observed this when I saw Gilyarova working with the villagers. She was not interested in, 80% or so of the women's repertoire. She was interested in that, you know, 20% that of songs that they can barely remember, and that she finds, you know, like the eldest songs, the old wedding songs, or the songs that having to do with the folk calendar, the agricultural calendar. That was what was interesting to Gilyonova, and all the other songs that they knew, she didn't turn on her tape recorder, or if they started singing like that, she would turn it off. She would also criticize how they were singing as well. And so I sat through many sessions like this, and I thought, somebody has to write about this. So I'm going, you know, I feel very passionate that what the women have in their repertoire is of interest, just intrinsically. Like, I'm interested in the people and how they view their folklore, not in some great folklore with a capital F that has to be preserved for the reasons that the scholars dictate. And so this was the impetus behind the book. And I wrote about this in my first chapter of the book. And this was not Svetlana's interest at all. She brought in what became chapter two, which is the story of the life cycle of a woman and the different ways that power is transmitted and possessed at different times in women's lives. So putting these two lines together, I think we really enriched each other's study. And also, she had not had the idea to focus on women. That was also my contribution. So the book shaped itself as a dialogue between these two threads in a way. And so I have to say, when I assign the book to my students, I often skip chapter one because, you know, it's like more, you know, more technical. Like, you have to know more and you have to care about historiography or scholarship. And yet chapter two is what everybody is interested in. So I assign chapter two to my students. But I think chapter one is really key for me. Like, it's kind of the backstory and the reason why the book exists. And then that influenced chapter two, influenced the structure of the book. So once we started talking about different stages of a woman's life, then we needed to follow up on that. And I was trying to write the book without chapter three, which is the wedding chapter. And I just realized it has to be there. I mean, this is the moment in women's lives, and it's the one moment that they all want to talk about. And it wasn't in my list of topics in my fieldwork, but yet every single interview had that in it. Like, every time we, you know, turned on a tape recorder to talk with a woman, she always wanted to talk about her wedding. So I had plenty of wedding material, and Svetlana also provided wedding material. And although her material was more like descriptions of actual weddings, you know, she belongs to an institution, the State University, which, you know, carried on the traditions of previous scholars, and they were always interested in the ritual. Right? Not the individuals who underwent the ritual, but the ritual itself. So all of those interviews were structured in such a way that they would elicit descriptions of a generic wedding. And our interest in the book is more like, how did the individuals see their own weddings and their own relationship to their weddings? So that very much, I think, influenced the book and became a huge thread in the book, was this idea of subjectivity and how people see, have their consciousness of of themselves. And then the rest of the book, you know, picks up that thread and traces it to different folklore genres and also different moments in women's lives.
So one very interesting moment you talk about is the influence of Soviet state on traditional rural life of women. So perhaps you could talk a little bit more about this.
The influence of the Soviet state. Do you have in mind?
So you say that the coming of the Soviet power change the traditional rural setting of lifestyle for women. So in what ways did it do so?
Oh, yes.
Hello.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, so really that describing collectivization and the changes that happened with collectivization in the late 1920s, in 1929 to 1930. And so the ways that that affected women was that, first of all, it made women more important in the family life, and it made men more peripheral to family life, and women became heads of household in more ways than one, whereas previously they had a more limited authority, and at this point their daughters also became more empowered and treated as heads of household themselves, so that there was a lot of challenge to the balshucha role. Since the daughters were more empowered by the state recognizing their authority as mothers, in other words, every mother is treated in a sense as an authority in the family, that is a challenge to the institution of the balshucha. So that, and the balshucha is the female head of family by definition, though, under the family structure of the 19th century, prior to collectivization, a balshucha is she who is married to a male head of family. But that becomes different in the Soviet period, where any mother is treated as a familial authority.
So I was really interested in this figure of balshucha. So do I understand correctly that this is the most empowered woman in the family?
Absolutely, yes.
And what does it make her the most empowered? So what other things can she do compared to other female family members, for example?
Well, the balshucha keeps, you know, the keys to the larder, so to speak, right? She feeds the family, she clothes them, she's in charge of the family vegetable plot, the little vegetable growing plot, and any domestic animals there. So it is to her credit if the family is well-fed, healthy, and has good morals. And by extension, then it is also to the credit of the entire family. But it is her job, really, to make sure those things happen. In other words, that they're well-clothed and well-fed and healthy-looking and behave properly. No, really, her husband is backing her up in that, but it's her direct responsibility.
So were it mainly balshuchas that you had a chance to speak with during your field work?
Well, as I came to learn later on, everybody that we talked to pretty much was a balshucha, because if you wander around and look in a Russian village today, you're going to see a lot of women-headed families, and often it will be an older woman. Rarely you will see a family where there's a younger woman in charge and the older woman is incapacitated in some way, or she's her authority is diminished. So a lot of times you'll see, you'll just meet those women, and that's who stays in the village year-round. And then in the summer, the younger people come. So in the summer, you can see more of the interactions between generations. But in the wintertime, you're going to see balshuchi staruhi, I call them. They're both, you know, they're old, but yet they are heads of families. And often there is no man present at all, no functioning man. If he's there, his authority is significantly diminished, either because he is absenting himself, and this is the pattern that we talk about in the book, or because he is drunk or infirm, or, you know, one of those many different options. And then occasionally you meet a family who is headed by a functioning man, a Balshak, and that would be the exception today to see that in a village.
So could you probably tell a little bit more about the pattern of a man absenting himself? Because that sounds very curious.
Yes, well, I mean, we trace it back to collectivization, which literally takes away, you know, a third of the men, the successful male householders out of the village. And then, you know, also involves their sons or those men who remain behind in the village in the collective farming. So that the household is less of a responsibility for the man. It's more his responsibility to be involved in the public sphere, in the collective farm or the local governance or whatever field he ends up being in. And whereas the woman will take charge of the household and the family, whereas previously that was shared. And so that pattern remained in the Soviet period. You see the results of it in a lot of families that are headed by women nowadays.
Very interesting. And perhaps this could be a good time to talk about gender, since this is such an important concept in your book. And could you tell us a little bit more about how you understand gender within your theoretical framework and how you work with the category of gender in your book?
Yes. So, I mean, we don't have a very complex understanding of gender. We're understanding it as a socially constructed set of, you know, kind of scripts or expectations for people who have, you know, taken on the those roles of particular genders. And we don't talk much about those who don't take on their more obvious gender roles. So again, that we talk in the conclusion about like silences in the book, that is one of the silences, what I didn't even mention in the book, is there are people, you meet people in the village who are going against their assigned gender roles. But we talk more about those who have, you know, really embraced those gender roles that are prescribed by the community and by tradition. And so that's what we're looking at there, and the process by which people, while accepting such a designation, like I am a woman, may take other, you know, detours, let's say, I don't know, a woman who no longer milks the cow, and her husband has to milk the cow instead. She doesn't view herself as less of a woman because, you know, she explains it as like, my husband is helping me. It's still a female task. And I think we mentioned in the book, like the husband will put on a kerchief while he's doing it to say like, oh, you know, the cow won't recognize me unless I put on a kerchief. But it also means that he's acknowledging and marking that as a woman's task. It has to be done by a woman. Of course, the cow could get used to somebody without a kerchief, but no, he keeps doing it, even though he's been doing it for, you know, 4 years or 5 years. He's still wearing that kerchief.
And something you say is that in your book, you also undertake the enterprise of studying gender through plots and scripts. So what do you mean by this?
Well, we mean that as we got deeper and deeper into our subject, we realized that a lot of these expectations that we're talking about, or all of them, are, you know, not only are they conveyed through stories, but they are solidified through stories. They're in a sense held up by stories. And so the scripts that come about in the stories, that come across in the stories, and are very important to people. And what we mean by that is the plots are the stories that are told about the past that are formative for people's lives, and that are kind of can be designated as a kind of and the scripts are those stories that are told about a future way of being, like when people imagine how they would like to be in their lives, that we call that a script. And so these plots and scripts can be heard all the time, like when people tell stories about their wedding, for example. They're often telling a plot of types of weddings or types of courtship that occur. And as the more stories are told, the more those stories influence other stories, and they become set conventional ways of thinking about this process of, of a couple becoming a couple, right? So it's almost impossible to make sense out of our lives unless we have models of how to make sense out of our lives. And that's what plots and scripts are. They're just the ways that people make sense of their lives.
I see. Something you also mention, and I'm quoting from your book right now, is that the social power of Russian rural women is a force that supports both individuals and social bonds. So that is very interesting. Could you please elaborate on this power which supports individuals and social bonds?
Yes, I think what we're saying there is that very clearly, a lot of these stories that people tell are designed to increase their social power. So increase their social influence, their ability to be a leader in the community, to get others to follow them, to have authority in the community. And so this kind of power is the social power that I'm referring to there. And so that power is a force that is going to support people as individuals as they make their way through life and decide how they want to work their lives out. But it also helps in social bonds. We see women as having both individual agency and a kind of agency that is really linked with other people. And so, and women's stories always bring us back to that. Like, we can never make an argument that, you know, a Russian rural woman is, you know, I don't know, a feminist or something like that, who's going to, you know, structure her life in a certain way, keeping in mind her own specific needs. She's always going to take into account the needs of others, at least in the generations we worked with. So that reference to the social bonds and the social power, the need to draw upon a community of others is so present. It never let us forget, their stories never let us forget that they were doing things for the good of others, whether that those others are their neighbors or they could be their ancestors, you know, always thinking about their ancestors and how to make things better for those who've gone already. It really struck us. I think that that's one of the themes that comes about strongly in the book, that it, as women, go about their lives, they are always thinking about the ancestors, always thinking about their debt, in a sense, to those other important others who made their lives possible.
So the three key words which you have in the title of your book are tradition, transgression, and compromise. And I understand that the transgression across times is something you were just talking about. And how about the compromise? So in what way compromise is a part of Russian village women?
Well, almost everything is a compromise. So every individual story involves compromises. We look at how Russian rural women grapple with the demands of tradition, and the tradition, claims its own. Like, it might say, you're going to conduct your marriage in such and such a way, or you're going to conduct your wedding in such and such a way, or you're going to, sing these songs after, your mother passes away, or you're going to, set everything aside and do this for your children. And so all of these, kind of cultural imperatives, they are constantly influencing people. And sorry, I lost the thread. What were you asking me?
I was asking about compromise and Russian women's life. Yeah.
And so they're constantly needing to respond to those imperatives, and nobody's, kind of meet those demands perfectly. Everybody's going to make compromises along the way, and those compromises could be, to suit her own needs. Like, we talk about the most simple compromise, like a woman whose hair is curly and short, and but her she needs to have her tresses combed out in the Russian traditional wedding, that's a compromise, like a very physical compromise. But it could be also a compromise, like a woman who we told about, who has a friend, a neighbor who is in pain and commits suicide, and then she covers it up. She makes sure that the woman is buried in the regular way and has a service set over her in a certain way that is specific for people who didn't commit suicide. And so that was a kind of a compromise that she committed in her life, and she carried the guilt of that throughout her life. Although, the woman came to her in a dream and thanked her, so she knew she'd done the right thing. But still it gnawed at her that this was a kind of a moral compromise that she had to make.
And in the light of these cases, how do you think your book fits, within the framework of feminist scholarship on contemporary Russia?
Well, we tried to take a slightly different tack than the one that I was brought up with. I was brought up with second generation feminism that, was pretty strident and not very sensitive to multicultural contexts, and, kind of said, like, women need to fight and, get these equalities that they are due. And I believe that in my own life, but I don't force it on anyone else. So so in this case, I don't force it on these women, because the women themselves don't see themselves as feminists. I don't see them as feminists either, but I see them as strong role models for other women. Role models that are applicable not just for village women, but for any woman. I mean, these women have enormous reserves of knowledge and strength and ability, and that is just awe-inspiring. So in a way, it's celebrating that, but it's also trying to understand all the different compromises that they had to undergo in their lives, including, you know, a lot of sexism and a lot of expectations on them that they couldn't possibly fulfill. You know, like after World War II, the expectation that, you know, women would maintain, you know, monogamous marriages with men and have children in wedlock. I mean, just it wasn't practical. So a lot of women had children out of wedlock, and, you know, that was just a cultural phenomenon they dealt with, and they dealt with it each in their own way. So there's no, in a sense, there's no generalizing about it, but in another sense, yes, we can say that everybody grappled with many different societal expectations and many difficulties along the way. And so just looking at the way that they did that, I think, is our contribution. And whether that's a feminist contribution or not, I mean, I think it is, but it's certainly not a second generation feminist view, I think.
Well, feminism can be understood in many different ways, right?
Exactly right. And you know, third generation feminism is a softer feminism that says, like, let's acknowledge that there's many cultural different ways of understanding feminism. And even, I mean, I would argue in the Russian case, you almost need to get rid of the word feminist, because the word is so tainted. It needs to be put aside and like, let's just have a talk about, you know, about women. So that, in a way, that's what we did, which is we're going to talk about women.
Well, I'm so tempted right now to take this conversation to a completely different direction on feminism, but I really want to stick to your book. And, you know, okay, there are many cases, some very anecdotal, which you describe in your book. And I was wondering if you could share something very memorable from your fieldwork.
Oh, yes. Let me think. I mean, okay, so everybody who works, who does ethnography in a Russian village will have a story of a grandma who they particularly got along with, who influenced them a lot.
The babushka. Yes.
Babushka, yeah. And such a one was this woman I've already mentioned, Valentina. And so a memorable case is, you know, she was memorable, just she herself. Maybe the time that, you know, I was there at the same time as her grandson. So her daughter had died, and I was more or less the same age as her daughter. So here I was, in a way, fulfilling a certain function for her. Her daughter had died a year ago. I showed up in the village, and she seemed to appreciate my presence. And so that little bond that was formed there, and she called me Karlovna because my dad's name is Karl. And they asked me at some point, the women, what my patronymic was. So I made up this Karlovna. And so she started calling me Karlovna, which is kind of an honor, you know, to be, because they will use that to call each other, the Balshuki, right? So she calls me Karlovna. At the same time, her grandson is there, and he is very unhappy that I am there, pretty clearly. Now, anytime I'm in the room with her, he will not come near, and I pretty much just comes to the house to sleep at night. She feeds him in a separate room. And then Easter came and we had to go to Mass, or we all, you know, we wanted to go to Mass, and she was relying on him to drive her, and he kept her waiting. And I was with her, kept us waiting. And we're standing out on the side of the road. It's cold. It's dark. It's like 11 o'clock. you know, in like, I don't know, March or February, it's cold out, and he doesn't show up. He doesn't show up. He doesn't show up. And finally he shows up and he's either angry or drunk. We don't know which.
Or both.
Or both. And I had to decide whether to get in the car. And I'm thinking, well, it's not very far. So, you know, I got in the car and she gets in the front and I'm in the back. And I think one other neighbor is there in the back too. And he starts speeding along this road. Luckily, it's a very straight road to the church. And he's speeding along the road and she starts yelling at him. And she's just like yelling at him and telling him to slow down. And honestly, I don't even remember if he slowed down, but I was just impressed that she, you know, told him off at that moment. And then she had him come pick her up later in the evening, in the morning, I guess like 2 a.m. And I made sure to get a ride with somebody else home. But I was struck by that. This grandson was so bitter. And of course he had just lost his mother a year ago. Okay. So, you know, he had many reasons to be bitter, and maybe I was the reason for his bitterness. I'll never know.
But is a pretty memorable story.
It's a memorable. Yeah.
Well, Laura, I think we've taken up a lot of your time now, but before we finish, I'd just like to ask you about your current work. What is it that you're working at the moment?
I am working on a project on folk music and dance and also religious revival among a minority group in Bulgaria. They're a Muslim minority called the Pomaks, and they live in southern Bulgaria. And I've been doing fieldwork there since 2012. So 2012, 2013, 2015, I went there for fieldwork trips, and I've been writing articles, and I'm now getting a book written on this subject, and looking at how they are kind of bringing their community to more of a sense of consciousness of the very existence of their minority, that they have the right to have their own distinct culture from the Bulgarian culture, from the mainstream culture. So it draws on a lot of the themes that I've studied before, such as revival and folk music and the functions of those things in the lives of people. And yet it applies it to a completely new context.
Well, that sounds very exciting. And I wish you the best of luck with this new research.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, I appreciated the chance to talk about all this. It's so interesting to me.
I hope you also enjoyed this interview with Laura Olson about the book she co-authored with Svetlana Adonyeva called The Worlds of Russian Village Women, Tradition, Transgression, Compromise. And we have more excited speakers who will be talking about their work in the forthcoming episodes of New Books in Russian Eurasian Studies. So stay tuned and take care.